Welcome to our new podcast. This podcast is about solutions journalism, a terminology which is new to us in Nepal. Mrs. Holywise is going to introduce us what is solution journalism. Holywise is currently a Fulbright Nehru Academic and Professional Excellency Scholar in Bangalore, India, where she is teaching solutions journalism at Mount Carmel College. In the US, she is a journalism teacher at Texas University in San Marcos, Texas.
Thank you very much for having me. My name is Holly Wise, and I'm a US-based journalism educator. I teach journalism at Texas State University. And for the last year, I've been working in Bangalore, India, teaching journalism at Mount Carmel College as a Fulbright scholar. And the area of my journalistic expertise is something called solutions journalism, which is the idea that journalists can rigorously report on how people and communities are responding to social problems. So I would define solutions journalism by saying that it is the act of journalists reporting on how people and communities and businesses and governments are responding to social problems.
Yeah, Worldview made some kind of interaction program with her, and we are giving you all the ins and outs how she presented to us in that workshop.
Okay, so I like to start with just a foundational definition of solutions journalism. This is something, again, that was coined by the founders of the Solutions Journalism Network, being rigorous evidence-based reporting on how people and communities are responding to social problems. So the two things that I like to point out about this definition is the rigorous part. These stories, as you might be reflecting on some of your own work, these are stories that are not fluff pieces, right? These are stories that are hard-hitting, often have an investigative framework to them, and they contain all of the rigor that we apply to any other story that we are writing. So I like to steer people away from this idea that solutions journalism are feature stories about how great individual human beings are for X, Y, Z reasons. Instead, this is rigorous reporting. And the other thing that I'd like to point out about this definition is the evidence-based portion of it. When I talk to students about this, I tell them, and you may relate to this, is that, you know, our sources will tell us information from their perspective, which is from their perspective. And it's our job then as journalists to find the evidence to support or refute the information that we are given. And the same is true for solutions journalism. Even though we're reporting maybe on development issues or social justice issues, talking a lot with NGOs or public policymakers, we're always looking for the evidence to support or refute the claims that they're making. In terms of the responses to social problems, sometimes we think of this in terms of broad, sort of global issues, but this type of journalism can be applied to a community problem. It does not have to be on a global international scale. It could be a problem that a specific colony is facing, or a state or region, or just a group of people, a group of individual people. So we'll talk just a little bit about this theory of change, journalists acting as whistleblowers exposing wrongdoing. You know, I know for a lot of journalists, this is why we get out of bed in the morning to do this work, is to expose wrongdoing and to hold power accountable for their actions and for what they say. And I feel as though in the West, and what I've seen in India now, is there's a cultural idea within journalism that if we just continually point out to our community all the ways and all the things that we're doing wrong, that our audiences will assimilate that information and self-correct. Right. So in the West, and again with what I see in Indian media, you know, it's sort of this daily dose of decline, humanity's worst attributes. Typically there's death involved. I remember when Ebola was making international news, and you know, it very much was just this daily kind of onslaught of like, this is how we're all going to die. And the idea is that if we keep interrupting our audience's day by this news, that we will fire them weekly, to self-correct. But if we look at how we, especially as a teacher, right, I'm looking at my students and I'm thinking about if I were to come to them every day and tell them all the ways that they failed the day before, but if I gave them no constructive criticism on how to improve or ways to improve, then eventually they're going to tune me out and just stop listening to me. And in many ways, our audiences are doing the same thing with our media as well. There's this disconnect between our audiences and the news that we are giving them. And in many ways, it's because of this news fatigue, where we just are so burdened by the negativity and the kind of overwhelming nature of humanity's problems without giving that whole picture of how people are solving the problem. So we say that, you know, in addition to being the watchdog, journalists should also be a guide dog as well. And people and society, they need to see credible examples of how society is responding to social. It's giving them that constructive criticism, that constructive feedback on ways that they can improve in the future. So I will say, I usually like to stop here and say that this is not journalists perpetuating a solution, and it's not journalists who are developing the responses. Okay? It's journalists who are covering the responses that are already in motion. Just as we cover the corruption and the issues and the problems that are already happening within our community, this is encouraging journalists to cover the other half of the story, which is how people and businesses and NGOs are responding. This is an example between two newspapers, one in Chicago and one in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Both cities have among the highest crime rates in the United States. Chicago is with the homicide rates specifically related to gun violence. And in Fayetteville, it is to do with robberies and burglaries and that type of crime. So both newspapers, obviously these are issues and problems within these communities that the journalists cover on a regular basis. So Chicago did kind of what we all have probably done is this investigative piece called Under the Gun, which was a multi-part series. But what they did is they really just focused exclusively on the problem of gun violence within Chicago, within the community. And Fayetteville decided that they wanted to do something different. So the editor of the Fayetteville Observer met David Bornstein, one of the founders of the Solutions Journalism Network. They met at a cocktail party. And they were just talking about ideas and ways that the Fayetteville Observer might be able to cover this long-standing issue of crime within the community. So what they did is they decided to look at this from a solutions journalism perspective, and it took them a year. This was a year-long project with multiple stories. And what they sent their reporters to 13 cities within 7 states in the United States. And the journalist's job was just to talk to these other cities and find out how these other places had solved some of the same issues that Fayetteville was working on. And then they brought that reporting back to Fayetteville and turned this into a multi-part series looking at different topics. So the idea, a key part of solutions journalism is to cover local problems, but by looking at effective models in other places, in other cities, it could be other states, it could be other countries as well. In the United States, one of our big problems is our rates of incarceration in the U.S. and deficiencies within the criminal justice system. And at face value, it doesn't look like there's a lot of solution to that problem. So what journalists have had to do is they've had to actually go outside of the country to look at how other developed countries are handling incarceration rates within their country and bring that reporting back to the U.S. So the part here that's underlined, these effective models, it's really important that we report on what is working in other places, but that we also consider what is not working in other places as well. Because there are responses to problems that fail, that do not work. But those are still newsworthy and could also provide insights for our audiences. So I think then from a solutions journalism perspective would be to still cover that story, to tell that story. Because the technology is not working and it's creating more problems for the environment than what it is supposed to help, then that is obviously a newsworthy piece of information, right? And we can also tell that story from a solutions journalism framework in terms of here's how it was projected to help and to work in the US and other countries. But here's how it's kind of falling apart maybe in other parts of the world, right? Because what works in one place is not easily or completely transferable to another location. So that's something to also remember is that yes, we can go to other cities and other countries and look for effective models, but we also have to understand that those cannot be, and maybe shouldn't be, 100% replicated, because you're dealing with different governments, climates, geography, even mineral, groundwater, etc. So we have to be able to address those limitations within our writing as well. I'm not familiar with this piece of technology, so I can't speak directly to the technology, but in terms of the story and what you said, that would be how I would address that from a solutions journalism point of view. So this is a story from the New York Times that was published almost a year ago. And this story deals with a very it's an important issue in India dealing with women's safety. Thank you. And certainly in the West, we have a very stereotypical mindset of India when people think of India. So it's difficult in mainstream media in the West to find stories like this one that actually addresses the problem through a solutions journalism framework. It tends to be headlines India is the least safe country in the world for women. Right, I'm sure you all remember maybe that report from a couple years ago, which there's some discrepancy within the methodology of the study. But in the West, those are the types of headlines that we see about India. So you can imagine when my friends, even now, they ask me questions about this. Like, well, are you safe in India? Well, I'm as safe in India as I am in Austin, Texas, or Chicago, Illinois, right? But it's how the media portrays these long-standing issues. So this is a story. This was a journalist who has worked in India for a while, and she did a story about this program that a constable has had for the last 8 years. And this constable trains girls through this 10-day free course on self-defense and how to keep themselves safe. And this was a timely article because it was around the time that this study came out about India. And it's a way to address the problem, but through a solutions journalism framework. So it's not ignoring the problem or ignoring the issue. It's saying, yes, it does exist. But the other side of the story is that this is one way that communities are rallying around to make their girls and their women more safe. The other story that we see in the West is about the heat in India. So again, my friends, bless them. They always ask, like, the number one question I get is, how hot is it in India right now? Well, then I have to explain, like, the geography of India, right? It's quite a large country with every climate. But when you look at the data, and this was a story that ran in The Guardian, if you look at the data, you see that heat-related illnesses have actually fallen and decreased over the last 2 years. From just over 2,000 heat-related illnesses and deaths in 2015 to about a little over 200 in 2017. And this was a relatively short article in The Guardian, and I think the reason for that is because the heat waves in India are a more well-known issue, even globally. So they didn't have to spend a lot of time in this article diving into the problem because there was a high public awareness about the problem. So what the article does is it goes into a little bit of detail about how governments and health institutions are responding to the issue of heat-related illnesses. And by doing simple things like opening public gardens during the hottest part of the day so that people can seek shade and shelter, painting the roofs white to reflect the sun. Hospitals now have an AC room in the emergency rooms where people who are suffering from heat-related illnesses can be cooled immediately. Doctors and emergency responders have been trained on how to recognize heat-related illness signs and symptoms. So all of these things implemented over time, sort of added up to this decline in the number of heat-related illnesses and deaths in India. The disappointing thing for me is that this is just typically not the types of stories, that, again, that we see out of India, which I think that in terms of journalism and media, I think that this is actually the most newsworthy story, is that the number of deaths and illnesses have actually declined over time instead of increasing as media has moved in many ways. I mentioned to you the Ebola story, and that was something where, even though I am in media and I'm a journalist and educator, so I understand how media works theoretically, but I very much fell for the hype, the media hype around Ebola. And I remember, I believe it was The Economist in the U.S. On one day they had this front cover of their publication, and it said, "Ebola is coming," and it was like in horror movie fonts, right? And the illustration was just very grotesque depiction of Ebola. And then the very next day, the same publication, their front page on the very next day said, "Here's how Nigeria solved Ebola." Right, so this very, on one day, like yesterday, this is how humanity ends. But then today I find out that there's actually been a response and a solution that was effective and working and that doctors had innovated around. And so the question then becomes, as media practitioners, our responsibility in terms of providing our audiences with both sides of the story so that they're able to see the problem and the issue as it exists, but they're also able to see how communities and people are mobilizing around solving it and around fixing it. Anything else before I go into a little bit more detail about how we do this? So I would say yes to that. From just on a very practical level, we can't, as you know, we can't assume that our audience is going to read the next day's story, right? Like we can only assume that they're going to read this article like right now, that they're not going to read the next day's about how it's actually being fixed and solved. And especially in the case of Ebola, that was such a wide known, there was such a high public awareness about that crisis that was unfolding, which was certainly a crisis in that part of the world, that I think the argument could be made that why not cover that and provide both sides in the same story, instead of trusting that your audience is going to stay with you through the next day's publication. So you touch on a good point about when does a story qualify, if you will, for a solutions journalism piece? And one qualifying feature is if the problem or issue that you're writing about is well known within your community. If it's a problem that no one knows much about, then it's probably deserving of a story that will uncover the problem at first, right? So that your audience is aware that this problem even exists. And that's where we see this merging between investigative journalism and solutions journalism as well. So what we've seen some of our newsroom partners do in the US is they'll do like a 5-part investigative series. The Chattanooga Times in Tennessee did a 7-part series looking at poverty in the city. And this series was a finalist for the Pulitzer 2 years ago for public journal. So it was a 7-part series, and each part of the series addressed a different issue related to poverty within the city. But much of that needed to expose the issue because there was not a high public awareness about the problem. And then the last story or two were written from a solutions journalism point of view after the journalists had done their due diligence in exposing the problem. Then they came back and said, okay, here's how the community is rallying around these issues as well. So that's one way that we see investigative journalism and solutions journalism working together. The other thing I will add to that thought is that the time and effort it takes to rigorously report a solutions journalism story is very similar to the time and rigor it takes to report an investigative piece as well. So to start, we're starting to talk about how people are responding to problems, then we have to start with a problem and start with an issue or an area of concern within our communities. So the important thing to do here, as you know, is to define the issue as specifically and precisely as possible. So this morning I was with a group of students, a media studies students at Kathmandu University, and so I asked them to give me some examples of issues that their demographic is facing right now. So the issue that they said was women's safety, especially with college-aged women. So that was the overarching problem. Then I asked them to identify the issue even more carefully than that. Like, women's safety is a very large topic. So I asked them to define the issue even smaller than women's safety. Then they started talking about public transportation, women's safety specifically related to public transportation. Once we had that defined, then we could start brainstorming about how the responses and solutions that they see to that issue. And then from there, we were able to kind of dissect those responses and come up with a reporting plan around that if they were to do that. So it's easy to start with sort of this big idea. The examples that I have here would be things like reproductive health or childhood well-being. It's good to use those large umbrellas, those kind of macro level stories as the starting point. Then from there we have to go for the small slice. What is a small slice of this that is really important to our audience, that is most newsworthy and most timely for our audience to know about? And that small slice is then kind of the guiding light of the rest of our reporting and the way that we tell that story, which will hopefully keep us from being distracted. I was working on a piece, while I've been in India, I was working on a piece about the cost of maternal health care for low-income women. And so it's a solutions journalism piece that's looking at this one particular hospital system in Andhra Pradesh that they've expanded to 11 hospitals. They've been profitable for the last 3 years. And my curiosity was piqued about how this was happening when their customer base are women with an earned family income of about 9,000 Indian rupees a month, right? So I was just really curious about how, what kind of business model that was. But then as I'm writing the story and putting it together, then I become entirely distracted by the infant mortality rates. And like, I just kind of start going down that path. And when I put the piece together and I gave it to my husband to read it and before I submitted it, and he was like, wait, this feels disjointed because you started out talking about one thing and now you're talking about something completely different. And I forgot what my small slice was. So you constantly have to come back to, what is the small slice? What is the thing that is most relevant and most timely, most newsworthy for your audience to know? And then stay with that. The second thing that's here is, this is a key part of the kind of the reporting process for a solutions journalism piece, is asking our sources and ourselves, who's doing a better job with that? Who's doing it better? And that is a question that will lead us to other people who are working within the same space, who have found innovative ways to create change around a specific issue. One example of myself doing that, I took some students to Baltimore, Maryland, and we were reporting on food deserts, which is defined by the United States Department of Agriculture as urban groups of people and urban places that are cut off for access to fresh fruits and vegetables. So we were doing some stories around that. And one thing that we came across was this idea of community gardens, where NGOs and churches had come into some of these urban communities and set up community gardens for the people who needed it. But what we observed was that a lot of these gardens were completely overrun. No one was taking care of them. You could tell they hadn't been utilized in quite some time. And as we started talking to the community, we learned that the churches and the NGOs who had started these did all the work, but then never communicated to the community that the garden was for them. And there was also this misunderstanding that because they were in need, that they would understand how to grow food. So there was this lack of communication, this lack of education within the operation of this response. So we started asking people this question, who's doing a better job with this? Is anyone? And if anyone is doing a better job, who are they and how can we find them? So that led us to another organization who also had implemented this idea of a community garden. But instead, this time they had communicated to the neighboring community. They set up classes to teach people how to grow the food, how to harvest it. They had a schedule where everyone knew what day it was that they were supposed to water, harvest, plant, etc. And this was actually a very effective way for them to implement this solution. So then we asked them, Do you know of anyone else who's working in this space who you think is also doing a good or better job at this? And then that led us to this one guy named Arthur, who's probably the most charismatic character I've interviewed. He met us in this neighborhood that he works at, and he's just one guy who noticed one day that there was a lot of waste left over from some of the vegetable markets. And then from there it grew into, he got a grant from the city, and it grew from there where now he has a kind of like a vegetable storefront just for people who are in need and just collecting leftover goods. So when we put the story together, we addressed all three of these examples that I just mentioned to you. The failed response, what did not work, and how it didn't work. And then we also illustrated the two examples of how it did work and some of the key components that these two people and organizations used to bring about this effective model. And the idea is that by doing that, you're able to provide your audience with these insights so that other people and other communities who are faced with a similar issue could have some reference points on how to go about implementing this particular response. The one thing that kind of satisfies both the watchdog and the guide dog journalist parts of myself is this knowledge and understanding that solutions journalism has the ability, like any journalism, to hold power accountable for their actions. And the way that we do this is that we illustrate to our audiences and to the public and to the people who we are holding accountable. We illustrate to them that the problems that they have said are unavoidable are now unacceptable. The example that I use to illustrate this is from the Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper in Cleveland, Ohio. And they did a series called Toxic Neglect. And the series was about lead poisoning in Cleveland. So in the U.S., especially in large urban areas, lead-based paint was used, especially in low-income housing and apartments, and it was poisoning and still is poisoning children because it causes cognitive and developmental delays in children. So many cities have completely had to go in and remove the lead-based paint and repaint the houses, right, to make them safe for the people who live there. And the people who most suffer from this are people who are low income, typically communities of color as well, the people who are most at risk for suffering from this. And Cleveland's attitude for past decades has been kind of too bad. It's just the way that it is. We have a health department, we have lead inspection staff, we have a policy, we have a register where you're supposed to find houses that have been banned. We have all these things, and if people are still being poisoned and affected, then it's kind of on them, their fault. So that point that oftentimes government will point to policies or point the finger at other departments and just kind of shrug it off and say, well, it's just the way that it is. This is an unacceptable, unavoidable problem for us. And these two journalists decided to approach the story from a solutions journalism framework. So even though Cleveland had these things that I just mentioned to you, what they discovered is that none of it was working at all. Yes, they had the registry where homes were supposed to be listed, but they weren't. No one was keeping the registry up to date. They did have lead inspection staff, but the staff was really small, and they would only inspect homes after children had been poisoned. There was nothing that was proactive to stop the poisoning from happening. So it was actually pretty bleak. It didn't look on the outset that there was much response to this problem within Cleveland to report on. So the journalists went to a different city, and they went to a city also in Ohio that had faced the same types of issues at this magnitude. And they started asking, what did you guys do? Like, you've reduced the number of houses. You have reduced the number of children who are being poisoned. Like, what's going on? Like, how did you do that? And they were able to bring that reporting back to Cleveland and write this story in this series that created this public outcry where the public said, wait, if Rochester can do it, then why can't we? And why aren't you? And so they published this kind of infographic, right, looking at the measure and then what successful cities do. And then here's what your city does, Cleveland. the inspections of homes in successful cities, they inspect homes before the children are poisoned. But if you live in Cleveland, you have to wait until your kid's poisoned before your house gets inspected. And this was a really effective way to, again, kind of shine that light on that power within Cleveland and hold them accountable for what they had not done. The impact from that, kind of what happens when you take away the excuses, is in Cleveland, it resulted in the health department director and three of the commissioners either being fired or resigning. They increased the city-led inspection staff from 3 people to 7. They passed a plan. The state said that if you don't adhere to these policies and changes, then we'll withdraw funding. The state published the list of banished homes. And then Cleveland now posts warning signs on affected homes around the land. And the journalists say, obviously because this was such a long-standing issue within Cleveland, it's a story that journalists would do and write and report on quite frequently. But in the past, they would always approach it from a problem-oriented framework. Again, kind of expecting that the public outrage would spur social reform, but it just wasn't working. Politicians would say, the only thing that ever came of the previous stories was a politician or two talking about how bad the problem was. So I'm curious, because the Indian journalists who I've met are quite comfortable with this blurred line between activism and journalism. U.S. journalists are not fine with this. There's this very strict distinction between journalism and activism. And here I'm hearing from you that in Nepal it would be similar, right? There's this line between journalism and activism. Okay. So my argument to that would be that by choosing not to report on some of these issues, I'm also advocating for something. Does that make sense, right? Like, even just story choice means that I'm advocating for something. So in my mind, and in the case of the Solutions Journalism Network, it's this idea that, why not report on the other half of the story, which is how people are responding to problems, when we're so ready to report on the failures and the problems. My other response to that is always that Solutions Journalism is just journalism. And so we maintain all of the same objectivity and kind of neutral bearings that we try and apply to any other story that we write and produce. And with that, there are newsworthy responses to problems that need to be addressed and that need to be told. And I think one thing that Solutions Journalism can do is that it can give journalists a way to tell a story about human rights issues without expressly saying this is the problem. Does that make sense? So I was talking to some Kyrgyzstan journalists, and they were saying we actually think that solutions journalism could work here because it's a way to highlight the problem, but to do it through this way of how people are responding to the issue, which could be less threatening to, so I'm wondering if that could be similar here as well. I don't know, you would be the expert on that. So this is a conversation that I have so much that I wish that I had a better answer, because it's something that we talk about a lot. And my students always bring it up as well, because they, especially in the U.S., they say, we're journalists, we're not activists. But again, we're advocating for something just based on the kinds of stories that we choose to tell. So I think one way that we can do that is by, again, with story choice. And if we're choosing stories that have a high public awareness of the issue and of the problem, then it's usually something that collectively we're all facing and we're all trying to find some kind of response to. The way that we then go about reporting that out is how we would report any other story, and discussing limitations as well, which I think is a way to make the story not slanted. The other thing which I can say now is that the solutions journalism story features the response, not a person, which means that it can be a little bit less slanted, because you're not saying, look at how great this one person is, or look at how great this one NGO is. The work becomes the hero of the story, not just a person. So the story is about the response to the problem and how the response came about, which I think even just by doing that, has a way to make it more objective and not as slanted. And then my argument to that also is that there are probably stories that, you know, if like with this story, this toxic neglect story, it probably feels, it might seem slanted against the government of Cleveland. But in this case, like, what is their side? Their side of the story is that they have these programs, they have these policies, but they were completely ineffective and no one was doing their job. So the purpose of this story was to hold them accountable for their actions. The University of Oregon, you might be interested in this, the University of Oregon has a program called the Catalyst Project. It's a student-run project that is doing this exact thing, blending investigative journalism and solutions journalism. So they have a guy, his name's Brent Walt, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who's heading up the investigative side. And then they have one of my former colleagues from SJN who's heading up the solutions journalism side. And so between the two of them, they're guiding students to cover local issues using investigative journalism and solutions journalism together. And I think that when you look at solutions journalism pieces, you'll be able to see representations of both. So one resource that you might find useful is through the Solutions Journalism Network. You're able to join the hub, is what it's called. And on there we have so many free resources for journalists and journalism educators. And one of the key features of that is the Solutions Story Tracker, which I think now there's like 5,000 stories within this database that are examples of solutions journalism from all over the world. So I encourage you to kind of take a look at that and see what some kind of living and breathing examples of solutions journalism is, and maybe issues that you might find kind of mirrors some of the calls and maybe how other people in other parts of the world have covered that. Just quickly, I know we've talked about some of this, but just kind of give you a few more pieces to add. There are four qualities of a solutions journalism story that we are looking for. The first is that we're going to hopefully provide our audience with this available evidence of results, not just reporting on people's good intentions, which, you know, there are a lot of people in the world who do a lot of things with the best of intentions, but it doesn't mean that they are effective. So the example that I give is, I was doing some reporting in Ethiopia a few years ago, and one of the villages that we visited told me this story about how an NGO from the West had gone and visited their village and dug a well, which is just kind of, that's what Westerners like to do, right? Go dig wells. And so they did. And then they went home, and then the next year they came back to check on the village and the well. And they found that no one in the village was using the well. It remained unused for that entire year. And so they were asking, like, why isn't anyone using the well? And the village chief said, well, you dug the well in our burial ground, and we don't drink the blood of our ancestors, right? So this touches on a couple different things. One, like, good intended people went and dug the well, but it was completely ineffective because no one was using the water. And also looking at this as a failed response, which, you know, there's a whole other discussion we could have about why this particular response failed. The solutions journalism story would tackle those issues and look at that. Why was this a failed response? And as a side note, Tina Rosenberg, who's one of the co-founders of the Solutions Journalism Network, she wrote this very in-depth piece a couple of months ago examining the ill effect that Westerners have when they go to developing countries to volunteer. You probably heard this term, voluntourism, where Westerners pay a lot of money to go and have these experiences where they volunteer and then also, you know, sightsee as well. But that's actually really damaging to local economies and to local institutions. And so this whole piece, it's a very, very beautiful piece, but it's a solutions journalism story that's looking at this completely failed infrastructure of Western volunteers and how we actually do more harm than we do good when we do this. The second thing is that producing insights that can hopefully help other people respond as well, not just inspiring people, but being part of this roadmap to give people ideas and constructive ways that other people are responding to problems. I talked a little bit about this, about how the stories will feature the work becomes the hero, the response becomes the hero, and how it happened. This how question is really important, as you know. And these are not just kind of fluff pieces about one person and how great they are for leaving their high-powered job and not doing social good. The stories are more rigorous than that. And the fourth quality is that we talk about any limitations within the piece. So if we're, you know, if we're writing about a new response or a new solution that we don't have a considerable amount of data for, then we're transparent with our audience about that. We're honest with them about any limitations that are within the piece. Some things that appeal to editors and publishers, because these stories tend to take time, and one thing that I've noticed in the Indian media landscape is that the deadlines are just probably even more brutal than ones in the US. So when Indian journalists hear me talk about this, they just kind of immediately are like, no, can't do it. Like, it takes too much time. We'll never get this from our editor. So one way that people can kind of sell this to an editor or publisher is we see this very high level of engagement with solutions journalism pieces. And that kind of, that E word, that engagement word is, can entice them to be a little bit more lenient in terms of giving reporters the time that it takes to report these stories. We see that SJN and now academics have done a lot of research around the public's reception to these types of stories, and we see that they spend longer on the page, on digital formats. We see that these stories are more shared more widely on social media, and that even on a community level, that these stories are a really powerful way to physically bring people together into a space to have a conversation about certain issues and problems. This last thing I think is important, making audiences feel powerful. It heightens their self-efficacy and makes them kind of less likely to tune out from the news. There are certainly stories now that are happening in the US that I just cannot read them anymore because it's just too depressing. And I'm very, you know, if I see a headline about a certain topic, I immediately tune it out and I just don't engage with it. And I feel like our audiences, we've just kind of abused them for so long with this mantra of oppression and negativity and bad news that in many ways we've driven them away from wanting to engage with us anymore. Just very quickly, these are some of the solutions journalism imposters. So these are stories that you might kind of on their face see as solutions journalism pieces, but a little bit deeper look would reveal that they're actually just kind of fluff pieces. So one would be hero stories, which are just about, again, kind of that CEO that, you know, who left their job and is now slaving away at an NGO. So hero stories are not solution stories. Obviously, public relations, kind of these masked, you know, thinly veiled PR pieces that you feature a new NGO or a new business trying to do social good. Those are not solutions journalism pieces. The afterthought stories would be ones that are, you know, 5,000 words about the problem, and then maybe the last paragraph is about, you know, here's how we're trying to fix it. Think tank stories, these are ones that in the US journalists fall for these a lot because it's kind of looking at what's going to happen or what might happen in 15 or 20 years. And the important thing to remember is that this is journalism, and solutions journalism is reporting on what's happening now. The magic bullet story would be about, this is actually the example here is from the New York Times. You can't see it, but the first line of the story is something like how for some it's just a soccer ball, for others it saves lives, right? Which is just, like, that's a lot for a soccer ball to take on. So these magic bullet stories are the ones that say this is the solution for everything. We're going to completely eradicate poverty by XYZ. And we know that social change is much more complex and much more complicated than that. These instant activism stories, we usually see these in the wake of a natural disaster or some kind of catastrophe. In the U.S., we see these stories a lot. After any kind of mass shooting, you'll see these instant activism stories pop up where, you know, people are outraged for, you know, 24 hours. So they organize a strike, or not a strike, a protest, or they march, or something. But typically in those cases, it's kind of this flare-up of activism right in the aftermath of the incident. But then it dies down, and kind of everything goes back to status quo after some time. And then popular opinions, you know, my students do this a lot where they, where they'll go out on the street and just talk to random people and get random people's opinions about something and then think that that's a really credible source. So it has its place in some reporting, but for solutions journalism, it's very so where to go for, so this is just a few examples. Bright Magazine and Yes Magazine are digital publications that have an international audience and cover issues around the globe. And they are 100% solutions journalism content. Bright Magazine was started by an Indian journalist who actually worked with the Solutions Journalism Network for some time, and then she left SJN to start this magazine. And I mentioned the Solutions Story Tracker, which if you just kind of need a boost, a morale boost of, you know, understanding that humanity is not all terrible, and that we actually might get through this together, the Story Tracker has some really great content on how people are innovating and activating around ideas and responses to problems. I also use this a lot for my students who might be doing research studies and who need case studies specifically related to public policy or business stories, social entrepreneurship, etc. So that is, as said, an introduction to solutions journalism, which I'm sure, like I said, I'm sure that a lot of you are doing this already. So I just want to thank you again for being here, for gracing me with sharing this time together. And I'm happy to have a conversation and answer any more questions and certainly hear from you and learn from you about the work that you're doing and how this could be useful to you. Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you.
Solutions journalism is an approach to news reporting that focuses on the responses to social issues. This is Sahaj Manshastra saying goodbye at the end of Freedom Chowtari podcast show.